Eyewitness News. Be there as it happens.
City News.
Hello, good evening. Welcome to Eyewitness News on 97.3 City FM, coming to you live from our studios at number 11, Dr. Martin Lupin Adabraka in Accra. My name is Selom Adunu. Tonight I'm here with
Nashika Caesar.
Coming up over the next 90 minutes, fate of President Akufo-Addo's Supreme Court and ministerial nominees hangs in the balance as minority and majority members of parliament take opposing stance on their approval. Voting currently ongoing on the floor of parliament. We will bring you updates of what has been going on in the House of Parliament. Also, Ghana's IMF request faces further delay following demands by the IMF for Ghana to secure financial assurances from its creditors before submitting application to the fund's executive board. And later, Electricity Company of Ghana disconnects power to Keta Municipal Health Directorate, which also houses a vaccine storage facility. We bring you updates on what to expect in respect of that vaccine storage facility. Stay with 97.3 City FM for more on this and other stories on Eyewitness News. And in business,
Ghana Stock Exchange pushes for more mining companies to be listed on the local boss.
So there's more in business a bit later on in the program. Eyewitness News is live across the country on all our affiliates and around the globe at citynewsroom.com. Your comments are welcome via our WhatsApp line 0549986996. You can follow me on Twitter at Selom Adunu. The hashtag, as always, is City Newsroom. Nashika gives us our first story.
Voting is underway by members of parliament as they decide the fate of President Akufo-Addo's ministerial nominees. This follows the conclusion of a debate on the report of the appointment committee on the ministerial nominees. Although the minority group has indicated that it will not vote against the nominees to help the government cut down on expenditure, the majority believes the result will favor the nominees.
All right, so let's take a trip to Parliament now and speak to our parliamentary correspondent, Ni Ayikwe Okan, to help us appreciate what's happening right now. Hello, good evening, Ni. What's happening in Parliament? We understand voting is underway. What can you tell us?
Good evening, Salom. So, as you just said, voting is ongoing and it is being conducted in an alphabetical order. So, currently they are at the K alphabet, where we had the clerk mention the name of Kojo Kum, who is a member of the majority. He is also the former Minister of Chieftains. We know that he is indisposed. So the speaker directed that the minority whips on both sides of the house, together with the clerk, you know, accompany the clerk to the MP to be able to cast his ballot. So that is where we are currently. Voting is still ongoing on the ministerial nominees.
It's interesting that just when we called you, the letter K was mentioned, and incidentally, one of the key matters in this particular vote is Honorable Kum, the former chieftaincy minister, who we know is not been so well. So where is he? Is he in Parliament? For which reason the speaker directed that the two whips go to him so he votes, or they are to chase him to his house or wherever he is? Where is he right now?
So, well, we know he is indisposed, but currently he is recovering a bit. So he's been trying to come to Parliament, although he's not able to undertake any major activities in the house. So when he comes, he sits at his, you know, prescribed seat, and then whatever that is needed from him, they approach him, and then he's able to offer. So that is why he's currently present in the chamber, and the speaker directed that the whips on both sides accompany the clerk to give the ballot paper to him to be able to cast his vote.
Oh, I see. So he's in Parliament, which means that he will vote, or he's voting. Now, give us a sense of... Okay, that's fine. Give us a sense of the numbers. All these are happening because of the closeness of the numbers we have in this hung Parliament. As we speak, we have 136 for NDC, 137 for MPP, and one independent candidate. 136 for NDC because the Supreme Court in that Asinov matter has disabled or has restrained the Honorable Kwesi from holding himself out as Member of Parliament. So NDC is short by one from its original 137, and MPP should have 137, but we understand some members of on their side are not there. What can you tell us about the numbers as we speak right now?
Yes, so not long ago we had the minority leader, Dr. Kesela Tuforsen, addressing the media and indicating that they are ready for the votes on these ministerial nominees because they are 136 and everyone is in the house to undertake this vote. But what we have gathered is that one member from the majority side is currently not available, thereby reducing their number. So what we have gathered is that the Kumewu MP, that's Philip Basua, is not available. His name was mentioned to come cast his vote, but the majority leader of CHMS informed the speaker that he is on his way coming. The unconfirmed report we are getting is that he is also in this post. So I don't know, maybe efforts are being put in place to ensure that he comes to the House to cast his vote. But as to if he will be able to do so before they complete the process, we cannot be so sure. We are just moving around to see how he would be able to get into the chamber to also cast his vote. So for now, the numbers seems not too good for the majority. So it's quite challenging. And this probably gives us a sense of why earlier we had the leadership on the majority side complaining about the modalities for the vote. When the vote was initially supposed to start, we had the deputy majority leader, you know, appealing to the House that they know that minority has 136, majority has 137. So why don't they just go with a consensual vote than to undergo the secret vote? But the speaker ruled that this is a key matter, national interest matter, of national interest. So every member of the House is supposed to, you know, participate. Hence the need for the secret vote, and that was ruled out. And then subsequently, they came out with the excuse that the position of the ballot boxes had not been placed well. So that was also rectified by the speaker. It was corrected, and then subsequently the speaker had to suspend the House to be able to engage the leadership because it was getting too much. The disagreement with all the processes that was supposed to take place before the election was getting too much. So the speaker had to suspend to engage the leadership of the House.
Very well. Let's hold it. We'll come back to the issue of the ballot box and the voting proper. But tell us about Adjoa Safu. You know, she's been one member who's been absent, you know, a bigger part of last year and all of that. In fact, there was an attempt to get her out of Parliament, triggering the relevant constitutional provisions and all of that. That doesn't appear to have worked. But where is she? Is she in the House? Are they counting her as part of the numbers? Is she out of town? What can you tell us about
her? The member of Parliament for Domkwa Abenyan, Sarah Adjoa Safu, is not in the House as we speak. So Sarah Adjoa Safu, as at now, that voting is ongoing, is not in the chamber. Hello.
So Sarah Adjoa Safu is not in the chamber as we speak, and the member of Parliament for Kumawo, Philip Basua, you also tell us, is also not in the House, but in his case, he is on his way. Did the majority leader say anything about Adjoa Safu when she was called, or has she been called yet?
Well, for Adjoa Safu, she has not been called yet, so we are waiting to hear what the response would be from the majority leader when she is called upon to come in.
But as far as you are concerned, she is not in the chamber.
She is not in the chamber, that I can confirm to you.
I see. So this matters like this, the constitution and the standing orders of Parliament tell us that the votes must be secret. And we saw a lot of, you know, back and forth on this provision of the law the midnight of the 7th or the 6th January when this Parliament was being inaugurated. Now I think that matter should be settled. Was there any debate or any discussion or conversation around the secretness of the ballot in this matter?
So So for now, with the secret ballot, there hasn't been any issue at all. What has currently been done is that we have two of the ballot boxes placed on each side of the house, and we have the whips, that of minority standing at where the majority side is, and then that of the majority standing at where the minority side is, just to be able to monitor the process. So that is what is currently ongoing. The speaker has indicated that when the voting is concluded, all those papers, the ballot papers, would be mixed together. Although we have them on separate sides of the house, they will be mixed together, and then the counting will take place, and subsequently the results will be announced.
The positioning of the minority, the majority, or the whips, you just said that they are positioned, you know, where the two ballot boxes are. Is the positioning such that they can see who their members are voting for, or where they are, they cannot see?
So where they are positioned, there's no way you would be able to see what the person is in. The person who is in the ballot box is casting his or her vote for. So they are well positioned in order not to, you know, see what is going on.
What can you tell us about the confidence levels of the two sides, the majority, minority? Do you have a sense that what can you tell us about the confidence levels of the two sides, the minority and the majority, in terms of carrying the day?
So just as I indicated earlier, we had the minority leader, Dr. Kessel Atuforsen, addressing the media, and he was very confident that they were going to have their way by not approving this. These ministers who have been nominated by the president, they believe that their colleagues on the other side, that's the majority side, who also buy into this idea that the government needs to cut down on expenditure, and they are ever willing to also support their call to disapprove these ministers to be able to help the government save costs. But the majority are also hopeful that they would have the numbers to be able to go through. Although they believe that now that it's a secret vote, well, they would also have some colleagues on the other side who also buy into the idea that these are members or colleague members of the House whose competences can be vouched for. And it's not as though these people are being turned down because of their competences. They are being turned down because of their competences but rather on the basis that the government needs to cut down on the size of the numbers. So that is the position on both sides of the house, and both are of the conviction that they will, you know, pull out successful in this.
We know that this whole thing started yesterday. The sitting was suspended. We understand that the majority chief whip, the Honorable Arnold Dompré, impressed upon the speaker that they wanted to have a joint caucus so they could discuss and see if they could come to some compromise. It obviously means that they could not reach the compromise. Do we know what went into that meeting, whether there were any proposals on the table? Do we know?
That meeting was a conclave meeting, so we do not have the full details of what exactly transpired. But then this morning we had the speaker coming in to tell us that there's been some level of agreement on certain modalities that would have to take place before, you know, they undertake their activity. So the key issues had to do with what was supposed to be done today. You know, the speaker had ruled that the vote on the motion would be taken today, although the debate was undertaken yesterday, the vote was going to take place. So that was part of the discussion, and then also the need to have the justices of the Supreme Court also debate the report of the appointment committee on these justices debated on, and subsequently a vote taken. And they also had a consensus that they were going to deal with the revenue bills that are currently before the House. So this was what the speaker made known to us, that it was part of the discussions that took place when they had a conclave meeting yesterday.
Indeed. So the nomination of the Supreme Court, the approval of the nomination of the Supreme Court, the two Supreme Court judges, is also in the balance. Do we know when voting for these two will also take place?
The speaker this morning made it known to the public that after, so the majority was actually proposing that these, you know, votes are conducted concurrently, but the speaker in his own way comes to think that it ought to be conducted separately. So after the voting on the ministerial nominees, it is expected that the vote on the justices, three justices of the Supreme Court, would also be undertaken.
Can you remind us again about why the minority side is against the nomination of the two justices, Justice Jewo, a High Court judge appointed or nominated to the Supreme Court, and Justice Kumsin, a Justice of Appeal, also nominated to the Supreme Court? What is the argument of the minority?
This morning, in the debate that took place in the House on these nominees, some of the arguments were that these, you know, officers do not merit the appointment because some of them haven't gone through the required constitutional processes that they are supposed to undergo. And then they also indicated that some had also served on the board, on public board, as justices, which justices of the appeal court before they were even going to the Supreme Court, which does not order well for the constitution, or it doesn't align with the requirements of the constitution. Hence, they are disapproval. And if you recall, December 11, we have two of them being approved, with the exception of these two, Justice Jewo and then Justice Justice Kumsin, who were not approved. So it was expected that today that would be done. And after the debate, the ruling was that no, they would have to hold on with that, have the ministerial nominees voted on before that vote was conducted.
Earlier in the day, we know that the leadership of the two parties, the NDC and the MPP, Chairman Asedu Nketiah and General Secretary Justin Kodua of the MPP, were in Parliament. Are they still there? And what have they been saying?
Well, we tried engaging them, but none of them has been able to grant any interview to us. We had the General Secretary of the New Patriotic Party, Justin Kodua, and some party members of the NPP, he being flanked by some party members in the public gallery, and then also the national chairman of the NDC, Johnson Asedu Nketiah, also flanked by some party NDC party members in the public gallery. So while the NDC is sitting on the side, at the top, at the public gallery, but I would say at the side of the majority facing the minority, Justin Kodua and the NPP members are also sitting at the public gallery on top of the minority facing the majority side. So that is their position in the House at the moment.
All right, thank you so much. But before you leave, when is Parliament rising? When are they going for recess?
Well, from the business statement that was presented for the ensuing recess next week, it was reported that the House is expected to rise on March 31. That is next week.
So the House is expected to rise next week. But the information you have also is that, by all means, the three revenue bills will also be worked on today.
Sure, that is the indication that we received from leadership of the House. But considering the time, well, it will depend on what the speaker will do after the two votes are cast.
Thank you very much, Ni Ayiko Okain, our correspondent in the House of Parliament, bringing us some updates on what's happening in Parliament. As we speak, voting is currently ongoing. They are mentioning the names of the MPs one by one, and it's in alphabetical order. As you heard from our man, Ayiko Okain, the Honorable Kum, who is the former Chieftaincy Minister, who we know has not been well, we understand is in Parliament, and he has been assisted to vote. However, we also understand that the Member of Parliament for Kumawu, Philip Basua of the MPP, and then Adjoa Safo, also of the MPP, are not in the House currently, even though the majority leader gives indication that the Honorable Philip Basua, who is also indisposed, is currently on his way to the House. It's a game of numbers. It's a very tight, you know, Parliament, as we say. It's a hung Parliament. The numbers originally 137, 137, and then one independent candidate who chooses to do business with the majority. But the Supreme Court, in that decision of their sin of parliamentary matter, restrained Atukwesing from holding himself out as a member of parliament. So even though he is supposed to be of the NDC, the NDC now has 136 against the MPP's 137. But Adjoa Safo is not around or in town, so that reduces their number to 136. And then the matter of the Philip Basua, if he doesn't come, that reduces their number further. But they have an advantage in the independent member of parliament. Let's speak to somebody who understands these things. Dr. Rashid Draman, executive director of the Africa Center for Parliamentary Affairs, to hear his perspectives on this matter. Hello, good evening, sir. Welcome to Eyewitness. A couple of weeks ago, the first deputy speaker of parliament, Abu Jose Wusu, said that Ghanaians should never ever vote for a hung parliament because of matters like this. He argued that the nature of this parliament dragged government business behind and it was inefficient. Is this not a symptom of that inefficiency we are seeing in this case, where simple things which could have been passed for government business to go on is having to endure days of debate and voting, and we still even don't know where we are going?
Well, Salom, democracy sometimes can be a little bit messy, and I mean, people who believe in it, you would have to live with that messy part of it. And that is what we are seeing. Over the years, I think both parties have been used to the convenience of having numbers and then, I mean, bulldozing their way through at every stage in parliament. Now, Ghanaians are telling them, learn to live with each other, learn to compromise, learn to give, and learn to take. But I think the posturing that we are seeing is as if it is all business as usual, that is a normal parliament where one party has a majority. But no, that is not it. And I think they are just failing to learn to live with each other. And that is why, for instance, I mean, the Right Honourable Deputy Speaker said Ghanaians should never vote for a hung parliament. I mean, with all due respect, he doesn't control how Ghanaians vote. And I think, Salom, we might wake up one day and we see even a worse scenario than what we are seeing now, where there will be a president in the Jubilee House and there will be a different party with a majority in parliament. And I would have thought that what is happening now would have been preparation for them, would have been a learning kind of process. Because I mean, this is like if you look at many parliaments around the world, I mean, no one party is given a solid majority. And they would have to work together, they would have to compromise, they would have to do some giving and some taking. I mean, we saw in the US, you remember, when the current speaker was being voted for, I mean, they went 15 times before a decision was finally made. So I think our parliament must just learn. Because look, Salom, right from day one, when we saw the portrait of this parliament, I think most of us said the only way that this parliament was going to be efficient was to build consensus, so that at least there will be some kind of deliberation of all matters that come before the House at all times. Noting that even with the slimmest of majority by the MPP, I mean, we are humans, and that's what we are seeing today. I mean, people are being willed to come into the chamber, people are unwell, and so on. You can't control that. And that is why there is a need, I mean, right from the beginning, for some negotiation, some consensus, some working together. But over the last 2 years and a half, what we have seen in most cases is the posturing from both sides is as if we are in a normal parliament where, I mean, the numbers are in one favor, one party's favor or another.
Talking about compromise or consensus building requires compromising as well and softening positions. Who should be doing, you know, who should be compromising? Is it the minority side or the majority side, which more or less is government or representing the governing party in parliament? Government has a duty to run the economy, to do all of that which it requires to do to ensure that the economy is put on the path of recovery. And Gavin appears to be doing that. It's appointed ministers. Now, minority is saying that they will not approve of these ministers because it's a further drain on the economy. You know, who should be compromising? Government, which has a duty to run the economy, and so constitution gives president power to appoint as many ministers as possible to help him do his job, or the minority, which is saying that we do not have money, so cut down on the business or on the numbers in your government.
Yeah, I think, Salam, I think the minority side, first of all, in terms of who should be compromising more, I think both of them need to compromise, because at certain times the minority also needs the majority in order to get maybe some of the interests that they represent reflected in the workings of government. But I think the side that has to do more compromising is the majority side, because they have been given the mandate. And giving the mandate doesn't mean you have a blank check. And that's why we have a parliament. The parliament serves as a check on executive power. So the minority is reading the mood of the nation. We see our senior citizens picketing and saying they have been asked to forgo their investments. You and I have taken some haircuts. I think a majority of the middle class in this country has lost some money, or has suffered from this economic situation that we find ourselves in. The minority is reading the mood of the nation, and that is why they are using that to provide a check that they have to provide on government. So it's on this matter, I don't think it's just unnecessarily obstructing government business. Yes, I think the MPP has been voted into power, but that's why we also have voted the parliament, so that the parliament can provide some checks and balances.
I think people
shouldn't lose sight of that and just think that, yes, the government has the business of running government. Yes, the business of running government, without a doubt. But it has to be done, I think, taking into consideration many things I think that are happening in our country.
So what will you say to people who think that the minority is just doing this as politics as usual, and doing this also to make the government look unpopular so they can carry through their objective of winning power in the next election?
Well, I think, first of all, that's their business. Their business is to try and do everything to win power. But I think, there are certain occasions when I think Ghanaians have frowned upon some actions that they have taken. But I believe on this one, Selom, I think every discerning Ghanaian would think that the minority side is not just unnecessarily blocking government because they are looking for power. I think they have put out their demands that, look, rather than appoint more ministers, try to rationalize and try to maybe combine some ministries and so on. And I don't think that that's too much to ask for. And if you take your microphone and go out, I believe 9 out of 10 Ghanaians are going to tell you, maybe at this point in our nation's history, perhaps that's the prudent thing to do.
I see. Maybe a final one, just to put you on the spot. What's your hunch? You think the minority will succeed in blocking the passing or the approval of the ministers, or you think the majority will find a way through?
It's very difficult to tell. So maybe on the face of it, if we look at the numbers, like your correspondent has said, one right now the NPP is reduced to maybe 135, because if Honorable Ajuasafo is not there, and this other honorable member
from Kumawu,
yes, is unwell, that gives them a 2% disadvantage. The NDC is at a 1% disadvantage. So on the face of it, if this goes through as it is going through, with the numbers holding as we know now, the NDC would have their way. But remember, Selom, I think we could also have some surprises. If you remember when the speaker was being voted for, you remember the secret ballot that you referred to on the first day of this parliament, we saw some surprises, and I'm not going to rule that out. It could be possible that, you know, maybe they could also have the NPP side could have some people from the NDC side joining their ranks and voting for some of these nominees, because some of these nominees might have friends. I mean, they might have some good relationships with people on the other side and so on. So I'm not ruling that out completely. We could see some surprises. But on the face of it, I think if the numbers hold as they are and everybody votes the way their party wants them to vote, particularly with the two party leaders sitting and watching a Big Brother kind of approach, Honorable Asiedu Nketiah is watching his group, I mean, making sure that they put up a good behavior. And I understand Justin Kodia is also there watching to make sure that their side put up a good behavior. It means that they want to avoid that kind of surprise that we saw on the night of January 6th.
I see. Thank you so much. Dr. Rashid Draman, Executive Director, African Center for Parliamentary Affairs, Eyewitness News on 97.3 City FM. Your comments are welcome via our WhatsApp number on 0549-986-996. Remember that it's a game of numbers. The numbers in Parliament are very, very close. Originally, 137-1371. And as we speak, Jesse Kwesin no more comes in for the NDC because of the Supreme Court decision. And also, we understand Ajua Safu is not around. And also, Philip Baswa of Kumawu, we understand he's indisposed and we are told he's on his way to vote. The Honorable Kum, we understand, who is also not well, has been able to vote. And by law, if the votes are equal, then the motion will be considered lost. Article 104.3 of the Constitution says that where the votes on any motion are equal, it shall be taken to be lost. So as we speak, the MPP is having a minus 2 because of Ajua Safu and the Kumawu MP. And so if the Fomina MP, who is an independent candidate but has indicated that he will do business with the majority votes, they may have equal numbers. And if that is anything to go by, then it would mean that the motion would have been lost. However, because it's a secret ballot, anything can happen. You are not sure who is voting for who. Like it's been said many times, the nominees have friends, they have relationships with the other side and a whole lot. So we may be in for surprises, but that is how the numbers look. Now, Eyewitness News on 97.3 City FM, a few of your messages. Adolf Newbury says, Salama, ain't we all overlooking one fact that the president has in a way reduced his government by foregoing 30% of the salaries and emoluments of the presidency ministers and others, saving costs to the state? Kennedy Onipayede says, minorities should not take part in the voting process because this government is taking Ghanaians for granted. Daniel Atia in Dansoman says, good evening, Salam. May MPP side in parliament lose the context in parliament. Amisku Pilele in Kasua Republic says, undoubtedly, Honorable Katie Hammond and other ministerial nominees were fantastic in their vetting. I'm very optimistic that parliament will approve them to work for the development of our country. Eyewitness News on 97.3 City FM. We'll take a short break. Return with more. Don't worry.
Eyewitness News. Be there as it happens.
Eyewitness News on 97.3 City FM. We are coming to you live from our studios at number 11, Dr. Martin Lupin at Adabraka in Accra. My name is Selom Adunam. I'm here with Nashika Caesar. Now, the Electricity Company of Ghana has reconnected power, or has restored power to the Keta Municipal Health Directorate. This follows an initial disconnection exercise carried out on the facility yesterday due to the indebtedness to the power distributor as part of the national revenue mobilization exercise being carried out by the company. The disconnection sparked fears that vaccines being held in the storage facility at the directorate risked losing their efficacy after some time. We've been joined on the line by Benjamin Entry, who is a public relations officer for ECG in the Volta region, to help us appreciate really why they would want to disconnect power to a key facility like the health directorate, which actually also houses vaccines. If you recall, in the last few weeks, there were a lot of reports about a shortage of vaccines, and now we have some. And then ECG, because the facility was owing, disconnected power to the health directory. Hello, good evening, Mr. Entry. Welcome to Eyewitness News. Have you considered the implication of this action on the vaccines before undertaking same?
Very good evening, Salam, and good evening to your fellow listeners. Well, actually, to give a brief background to this incident, it is important for our listeners to note that ECG has not disconnected any hospital within the Volta and OT regions as well. Then again, it's part of our exercise. So when we started the exercise on Monday, our team noticed that the Keta Health Directorate, which is about 4 kilometers away from the Keta Municipal Hospital, I had put that on our docket that the old. So our team went there to engage. And like I said, as a company, we don't take delight in disconnecting customers because disconnection is the last resort. As a company, you know, we are into the business of buying and then selling. So if the customer does not use their power, it becomes a stored energy, which is a cost to us. So we don't take delight in disconnecting customers. However, this exercise is much more of engagement, engagement, engagement. So we went there on Monday to engage them. That you owe us about 24,000 Ghana cedis. And the last payment was 2021, which has been unfair to us. So we would have really wished that we were paying something small gradually and all that. So during the engagement, we could not get positive feedback. And then the issue of disconnection came up. But then we noticed that they had the vaccines already, which was stored in a movable fridge. So on Monday, our team did not disconnect. I engaged them that kindly move, because the fridge is a movable one. So kindly move the fridge to the next place, which is not part of the meter, so that we are disconnecting. The people agreed to do it. But the next day, which was Tuesday, when we went there, the situation remained the same. We kept appealing to them that we needed to more or less like carry out that exercise in order to find a way of engaging them. You know, in the Volta region, all the hospitals combined were close to 8.9 million. And it's a sensitive area, so we cannot go ahead and then go and then disconnect the hospitals, which has led us to engaging them, That is why most of us OS for more than 2 to 3 years. So, and we started engaging the whole hospital alone, owes us 1.5 million Ghana cedis. We visited them since last week, and that has led them making payments of 40,000 Ghana cedis today. So, with the Keta Health Directorate, on Tuesday, the discussion went on, and then we're like, you folks should try and then move their back, because it's a movable fridge. If you've seen the pictures, which we can share with you. Then again, they did not go ahead. So on Wednesday, it's rather unfortunate that the disconnection happened. And then it led to the engagement between the ECG company and then the Volta Regional Health Directorate. So we had an engagement yesterday together with all the health administrators. You know, all the hospitals in the Volta region have administrative and medical suits. So we had an engagement with all of them to be on the same side. In present was the Volta Regional Health Director and then the Director of Finance for the Ghana Health Service. So we agreed on a roadmap and then agreed on further consultation. So today, the Volta Regional met the Volta Regional Health Directorate, and now have a clear-cut area on how to go about this issue. So as we speak, the place has been reconnected since morning.
I see. So you disconnected the directorate for 2 days. And have you...
Not 2 days.
So you disconnected on Wednesday, Thursday, and you reconnected today?
Yes.
So that's more or less 2 days, is it not? So have you been told or have you found out what the status of the vaccines are now? Or you've not done that? Have you been able to find out what the status of the vaccines are?
We were part of our engagement. So in the engagement, we realized that everything was still intact over there. So there was no cause for alarm. In the part of our agreement in today's meeting with the Regional Health Director, the Deputy Director for Clinical Services, the Deputy Director for Human Resources, and the Deputy Director for Administration, all these people were present because we need to know where we are. And it was during the engagement that we realized that as part of the 8.9 million, it included bungalows at the hospital. So we had an agreement that the regional director was going to write to all of them that all those occupying the bungalows were going to pay the bills themselves. That was one of the agreements we reached today because it was part of the debt. So once the individual stays in the bungalow, they were supposed to pay. But it was one of the headwinds we made today as well. Then again, the issue of mortuaries also came up, which he said we'll also find a way about it and give us a feedback. Either they will find a way of giving where we will pay within prepaid zone, giving that area prepaid or whatever, and they will get back to us as well. Then again, we realize that there are some hospitals that are under charge, where it has been revealed to us that as part of the charges that they give to customers, it includes utility charges as well. So for them, we are going to have further discussions with them in terms of how they are going to make payments. Then we have realized that there was the whole teaching hospital, which we were told is an autonomous hospital with a CEO and a board. So we engaged them that that's what can be made payment of 40,000 Ghana cedis out of the 1.4 million Ghana cedis the whole world. But though it's not enough, the 40,000, we understand that times are hard, and we know that these areas are sensitive areas. That is why no disconnection has happened for the past 3 years. But we will keep on engaging them, and because engagement is the way to go. Disconnection is the last resort. Because we all accept the fact that they need the power to run these essential services to our family members. But we should also not forget the fact that if ECG fails to collect the revenue, the entire power sector, i.e. the electric supply chain, might not meet its needs, and then even the power might not be available. Because the money that ECG collects is what fuels the power sector. We are the bottlenecks. Once we collect the IPPs, the transmitter, everyone gets paid, then we keep the power sector running as well.
I see. Just before you go, do you have a sense of how much the ECG has collected so far since you began this exercise in the region?
I can give you the figure as of yesterday.
Very well.
So you realize that on Monday, we collected 3 million Ghana cedis in the Volta region alone. On Tuesday, we collected 2 million Ghana cedis alone. Then on Wednesday, we collected 2.5 million Ghana cedis as well. Then on Thursday, which was yesterday, around 2.3 million Ghana cedis. So this figure is yet to come out. So largely, we've made an improvement because you could realize that those hitters who come to this exercise, a whole week we could collect around 3 million Ghana cedis. If we're able to collect 3 million Ghana cedis within a day, that should tell we've made progress with this exercise. And we want to commend all our customers that have cooperated with us, because we know that times are hard, that impacting our unit management, but we want to commit their traffic act by paying their bills to enable us achieve our target and then keep the power sector running as well.
So it means you've collected some 9.8 million, almost 10 million, out of how much?
Well, the total debt profile of the entire company is 5.7 billion, but in the ECG Volta region, we're looking to collect around 220
million. 220
million. 8.9 million. Yes, out of the 8.9 million is with the hospital, i.e. the health services, which are quite an essential facility, which we need to engage. There are monies elsewhere, too, that we are still engaging them, and very soon we will come out with those figures, and then the companies that owe us as well.
Thank you so much, Benjamin Entry, PRO of the ECG in the Volta region. Thank you so much for speaking to us on Eyewitness News. Eyewitness News on 97.3 City FM. Nashika has some more stories.
While the Food and Drugs Authority, FDA, is reiterating its advice to Ghanaians to purchase the authority's approved drugs and foods only. This comes after the FDA warned the public to desist from the purchase and use of Esricare artificial tears and Delsam Pharma's artificial tears eye drops, which have been found to be contaminated by the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention. The eye drops are suspected to have led to the death of 3 people and vision loss in 8 patients in the United States. Speaking to City News, the Deputy Chief Executive in charge of the Health Product and Technologies at the FDA, Seth Sianekis, urged persons who have used the product and are experiencing some symptoms to immediately report to a health professional.
The 2 products are not on the Ghanaian market, they are in the US market, but it is suspected that they have led to 3 deaths and 8 patients losing their sight. And so we attach a lot of seriousness to it. And because the world is now a global village, we thought that it is important we pass this information across to our people here in Ghana, because maybe somebody or some people have it that they are using. But I must say that currently, from our database and from the work that our market surveillance people have done, we have not found any on our market, and it is not a product that we have registered or given market authorization to, and therefore we don't expect to see any commercial activity with it in terms of it being sold. Is that if anybody is using Esricare artificial tears or Delsam Pharma artificial tears, then please stop using it immediately and send it to any office close to you, an FDA office close to you, or even to any pharmacy close to you. For medical products, before we can put them on the market, you have to ascertain the quality, the safety, and the efficacy of the product. And therefore, it is very important that everybody who is buying any product on the market ensures that these are products that have been registered by the FDA, and therefore FDA can assure of the quality, the safety, and the efficacy. This is very important. We also want to use the opportunity to tell the public that please, when you are buying medical products, look at the expiry date.
Seth Seneke is the Deputy Chief Executive Officer of the Health Product and Technologies at the Food and Drugs Authority. Now, the Director General of the Public Affairs of the Ghana Armed Forces, Brigadier General Eric Agrikwashi, has defended the invasion and brutalization of residents of Ashaiman by soldiers. The Military High Command took responsibility for the widely criticized invasion of Ashaiman, a suburb of Accra, over the killing of a soldier trooper, Sheriff Imo. Hundreds of residents were assaulted and left traumatized in what was described as an intelligence-led exercise. Speaking at the annual general meeting on National Public Relations and Communications, the Institute of Public Relations Ghana Brigadier General Agrikwashi says the force has been praised for the much-condemned exercise.
Nobody hears them until you have heard some small group of people sitting behind the microphone, have access to pen and paper, and then pushing things out, they're making it look as if the whole country is against. I'm not defending or justifying our action, but the number of calls that I've received and the institution has received thanking us for the access in Ashaiman. You're happy about it. It's funny. But people are asking that, oh, General, so why would you do that again? Yes. Because if you live within that enclave and at a certain time of the day, you couldn't go to certain areas and these things happened, you appreciate. The actions of the troops, or not even all of them, some of the funny thing is that some of the pictures that people saw were pictures taken by soldiers and posted on their Facebook and WhatsApp pages. There's not a media person who even got those things, and it's something we are dealing with. We have gone to do the wrong things, and we are still putting it out there, and the media is using it against us. You get my point. But, like, the question you asked, if you could do something different.
Maybe more stakeholder engagement.
No,
maybe
it's not an engagement, but the way we manage social media now is something we are paying serious attention to, because all these things is because of the way social media is being handled. Because some of the pictures that came out were brought out by our own people. By our own people. They took the pictures, posted it on their pages, and then it went viral. I don't know, some of the things people wouldn't have even seen them. But I just want you to be aware that there are a lot of people who are happy that we entered those areas in Ashaiman. But maybe if you live around that area, you understand. But for the war incident, it's complete no-no. But once in a while, me myself as a civilian, I was slapped by a soldier. Central Bank in Kumasi. Finally, I was wearing this same type of dress because my father used to be a soldier. And then he sold trousers for me. I wore it, went to the market to buy something. A soldier saw me. Why are you wearing this? That's all. My father is a soldier. So yes, he take our uniform and give to their children. The next thing was a slap. Bang.
Okay, but I think, Brigadier General, they told, okay, I'll let Mr. President speak. Please go ahead.
Brigadier General Agri Kwashi is the Director General of Public Affairs of the Ghana Armed Forces. Now, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, has asked Ghana's government to secure financing assurances from its partners and creditors before a request for a bailout is presented to the Executive Board for approval. Responding to a question at a news conference in Washington, D.C. on the status of Ghana's application before the Bretton Woods Institution, the Communications Director of the IMF, Julie Kozak, said the IMF is engaging the Ghanaian authorities on the bailout request, but at the same time seeking assurances from Ghana's partners.
So, on December 12, 2022, the IMF reached a staff-level agreement with Ghana on a three-year program supported by an arrangement under the ECF. This program was worth about $3 billion. Ghana also requested a debt treatment under the G20 Common Framework. Financing assurances from partners and creditors are necessary for presenting the program request to the IMF's Executive Board for approval. We continue to engage closely with the Ghanaian authorities while they seek these assurances. And we're calling on bilateral creditors to support Ghana's effort to restore debt sustainability, form an official creditor committee, and deliver the necessary financing assurances as soon as possible. The IMF program aims to support Ghana's efforts to restore macroeconomic stability, debt sustainability, while also protecting the vulnerable, preserving financial stability, and laying the foundation for strong and inclusive growth.
Julie Kozak is the Director of Communications at the International Monetary Fund. Meanwhile, Ghana's Finance Minister Ken Ofori-Atta has had positive and encouraging meetings with Chinese officials in Beijing regarding the restructuring of Ghana's debt. A tweet on the official Twitter page of the Finance Minister on Friday said government is looking forward to securing external assurances very soon, even as it passes the outstanding domestic revenue bills in Parliament.
Eyewitness News on 97.3 City FM. Let's have a quick conversation on this with Professor Godfrey Bumping, who is an economist with the University of Ghana. Hello, Prof. Good evening. Welcome to the program. It's a bit not clear what the position is now. From what the IMF is saying, is it a given that by the end of this month, or maybe early next month, we're going to have the approval required to make us access the $3 billion we are asking for, or we necessarily have to find a way of bringing our creditors to a certain point before we can get back to the executive board?
Thank you very much, and good evening to our terrorist listeners. Thank you for the opportunity to share my considered view on this matter. Okay, so thank you very much. I think when Ghana reached staff level agreement with the IMF in the middle of let's say December 2022, and the press conference that followed, the IMF was very clear that even though the staff level agreement has been reached, it can only go to the IMF board for approval when certain prior actions are met. It's probably one of the first time in our history or in recent time that we have to go through this journey. When Ghana applied for the IMF program on August 6, 2014, for the 16th IMF program, that kicked in from April 3, 2015 to April 2019 with 1 year extension, there was no need for these considerable prior actions before the staff level agreement that was reached went to the board. This time round, the IMF is saying that there are certain prior actions. And why are these prior actions very important? The IMF knows that without debt restructuring, without assurance from our partners, bilateral and multilateral partners, there is no way an approved IMF program can be effective in restoring macroeconomic stability, debt sustainability, and engineer inclusive growth. That's very clear. Why is that so? You just look at it. When it became clearer that Ghana needed to restructure its debt, the original proposal that was announced in December, government had meant to restructure close to 137 billion CDs of state debt. It ended up restructuring something less than that. So at the end of the day, the universe of eligible bonds that were considered were actually lower than the 137. Then the original proposal was that government wasn't going to pay any coupon the whole of 2023. That would have meant that those coupon payments in dollar terms would have been frozen and made available. Government, so at the end, what I'm saying is that the government didn't get exactly what they sought out to achieve from the domestic debt restructuring. Great. What that meant is that the gap from there will now have to be closed also. So the attention then shifts to external debt. External debt, you have the bilateral and external debt commercial. Now, if you look at the approach of the external debt commercial so far, it tells you that it's not going to be an easy route in terms of how quickly we can get that done, because government cannot and will not be able to treat the external commercial in the same way that they treated domestic debt holders in Ghana here. Now, what that means is that it will take a little while. Okay, then you want to focus on external bilateral. That is particularly important. So the IMF, as part of the announcement of the staff level agreement, indicated that in addition to taking steps to comprehensively restructure your debt, they also need assurance from our creditors, bilateral and then multilateral, that they will continue to help the country close the funding gap. At this stage, that is even more important now than actually restructuring the rest of our debt. Why is that so? Now, if you pick the 2023 budget alone, which has been approved by budget Parliament, the deficit in that budget alone is over 60 billion CDs. In dollar terms, you are looking at something close to $5 billion in deficit that has to be closed this year alone. Now, given that the country has lost access to the euro bond market, you cannot get dollars through the external debt financing that we had been used to over the years because we had been priced out. Then again, in the domestic market, in the medium to the long term, government has been priced out. So it means that that deficit has to be closed. Now, the IMF knows very well that with this deficit for this year, next 2 years, in fact, if you look at the projection from 2023 to 2026, is full of deficits. In fact, the energy sector indebtedness alone from 2023 to 2026 is over 70 billion cedis. That has to be closed now. So what that means is that if IMF approves its program in the midst of this deficit, the program can only achieve limited effectiveness. And that is why now what is critical now is that assurance that they will continue to support the country in closing the funding gap. Now, how can the funding gap be closed? The funding gap can be closed either through debt relief or fresh funding. That is what the IMF is looking for, or that is what Ghana is looking for from our external bilateral and multilateral partners. So far, there are indications that the African Development Bank and the World Bank are largely on board, but then again from Paris Club creditors. But they need also from the non-Paris Club creditors because the gap is so wide, okay? And therefore, they will need all these people to come on board. So we either achieve debt forgiveness from, let's say, China, okay, or China commit to giving us fresh funding. And so the country is looking from our development partners, bilateral, multilateral. That is where we are now. Now, Ghana's case is particularly complicated because the government so far has failed to do the needful by helping to close the gap faster through expenditure cuts. So what you do in instances like this is for the country then to show leadership and say that, look, I have a funding gap and I cannot go to the Eurobond market in the next 2 years or so, again, I cannot borrow long-term from the domestic market. So what we have to do is to lead by example, cut expenditure, wasteful expenditure, things that we can do without for the next 2 years or so, as a way of also closing the gap. Because you can close the gap through revenue enhancement, and also you can close the gap through a combination of expenditure cut. But the government so far has failed, unfortunately. And it's so sad that and all that we are doing and thinking about is to generate more revenue whilst we keep our lifestyle as though we are in the harvest season. No, it doesn't go that way. You remember the German ambassador was telling us that, in fact, these are diplomats. Typically, they wouldn't come openly the way they did. But you should know that people are getting fed up with Ghana. We should know that there is fatigue within the donor community. Development partners are concerned in terms of our excessive borrowing. And if somebody comes to tell me in 2023 that we have not been reckless with borrowing and the rest of them, I don't know what that means now, because the verdict on our borrowing spree was actually delivered in the third quarter of 2021 when the market kicked that out. Because the way the market mechanism works is that if you fail to discipline yourself, the market will close you out and discipline you.
I see. Very comprehensive analysis on the matter you're giving us this evening. We are grateful for your considered view on this matter. Eyewitness News on 97.3 City FM. Professor Godfred Bumpin is an economist with the University of Ghana, and he's just been speaking to us on Ghana's position in respect of the IMF bailout we are seeking, and what the IMF has been saying, that they expect Ghana to secure assurances from other creditors, China especially. Eyewitness News on 97.3 City FM. It's time for City Business News, and we'll do that just after this break.
Get the details. Every significant financial transaction, every market movement, and all the policies that affect your business. City Business News. Be informed.
It's time now for City Business News on Eyewitness News, powered by citybusinessnews.com. My name is Nashika Caesar. The details. The Managing Director of the Ghana Stock Exchange, GSE, Abina Amwa, is advocating for a deliberate strategy to get more mining companies to the list on the local boss. Currently, there are only two mining companies on the GSE, a situation she posits will not help boost the capital market and grow the mining sector. She made a call at an MOU signing ceremony between the Ghana Stock Exchange and the Minerals Income Investment Fund.
We are establishing a practical framework to embed the minerals and mining asset class as a viable investment opportunity for retail and institutional investors in Ghana and indeed regionally. We aim to see businesses operating in the mining sector raise capital on any of the Ghana Stock Exchange's three markets: our main market for equities, the alternative or growth market for SMEs and junior firms, and the Ghana Fixed Income Market for long or short-term corporate debt securities. This collaboration is an important milestone for both organizations as we seek to increase the listing of mining companies on our markets, support the growth of the Ghanaian economy, and create wealth for our citizens. As many of you are aware, the mining sector is vital to Ghana's economy. We are committed to helping it grow even stronger. We believe that one of the best ways of doing this is by promoting local investments in that sector.
That was the Managing Director of the Ghana Stock Exchange, Abina Amwa. Moving on, the management of the AngloGold Ashanti, Iduapriem and Goldfields Tarkwa Mines have assured that the proposed joint venture between the two companies will not result in job losses as feared. The merger, if successful, will make the company the largest gold mine in Africa and is expected to significantly cut down on the production cost. The proposed joint venture is expected to take place by the end of 2023. Speaking at a press briefing in Accra on Friday, the managing director of AngloGold Ashanti Gold Mines, Eric Esubuntin, revealed that the new name of the company will be Goldfields Ghana Limited. He further stated that his outfit will have a 30% stake, while Goldfields will have 60 stakes, with the government having 10% in the company.
Of this joint venture, what we are focusing on to unlock value is not about cutting jobs. It's about unlocking value by bringing two ore bodies together, leveraging of the efficiencies and grades and flexibility in planning and so on that you get from each of those operations coming together. It's not about job cuts. We've already said that this joint venture is not going to have any major impact on employment. There could be a relatively small impact on some jobs, in terms of it. And it could be a change of job, not necessarily losing your job. But even in those situations, we'll work through it together, the two HR teams, on a combined structure. And those that will be impacted, we'll look at opportunities to redeploy them in other areas. It's only after that, that if we can't find a redeployment opportunity that we talk about compensation, and we'll do it the right way, underpinned by our values, driven by law, and our collective agreements, and most importantly, being transparent and open to employees as we do so.
Eric Isuguntin is the Managing Director for AngloGold Ashanti Gold Mine. Now, the Ghana Chamber of Mines has strongly condemned the recent attack on the Benso concession of Golden Star Resources Wassa Mine in the Western Region, which resulted in several injuries and millions of Ghanaian cedis worth of properties damaged on Thursday, March 16, 2023. Illegal small-scale miners were alleged to have set fire some properties belonging to the Golden Star Wassa Mine at Bensu in the Western Region. Speaking to City Business News, the Director of External Relations and Communications at the Chamber, Ahmed Nangtoma, expressed concern about the growing insecurity for workers and the mining industry as a whole and called on the government to prioritize the security of the mines.
Our concern is about the safety of the mining operation, because with this they realize that most of the time the community or people pretending to be from the community will just mobilize themselves and go to a mine gate, attack them and ransack their property. So this is becoming one too many, and we are concerned that if it is not stopped, it will affect the mining operation. And as you know, mining is the highest foreign exchange earner for the country. If the operations go down because of insecurity, it's going to affect the economy and the whole nation as well. So our concern is that we need to have a way to resolve this issue so that these disputes do not become and turn into a violent attacks on companies.
That was the Director of External Relations and Communications of the Ghana Chamber of Mines, Ahmed Nangtoma. Finally, the Ghana Cocoa Board has begun enrolling cocoa farmers in some districts of the Ashanti region onto the Cocoa Farmers Pension Scheme. According to officials of Cocoa Board, the exercise forms part of a broader strategy to incrementally enroll cocoa farmers across the country onto the scheme. City News' Ashanti Regional Correspondent Hafiz Tijani reports.
Cocoa Board embarked on a three-week pilot phase of the scheme at New Edubiase in the Ashanti region after it was officially launched by President Akufo-Addo in 2020. The pilot exercise was to allow officials to educate and sensitize cocoa farmers on the scheme and train LBC staff in the use of mobile phones to conduct cocoa purchase transactions in the cocoa management system. Cocoa Board says the exercise has been of immense help and has thus moved to implement the scheme.
Cocoa farmers in Dwaso, New Edubiase, Antua Krom, Bekwai, Obuasi, Ninahini and Tepa, who have been registered under the CMS and given cocoa cards, are being enrolled at designated centers. We have therefore employed 260 enumerators, CMS enumerators, to visit cocoa communities, and we encourage farmers to get enrolled and contribute towards their pension. As the slogan of the scheme goes, Edumaforji pensioner, Okwanisu Bejibi.
Chairman of the Board of Trustees for the Cocoa Farmers Pension Scheme, Daniel Edumensa gave further highlights of the scheme's implementation when he spoke to journalists in Kumasi.
For the start, the Ashanti and Western South Cocoa regions have been selected for this phase, which is the phase one. Altogether, some 15 cocoa districts where data captured by the CMS have been declared clean or deemed comprehensive are involved. There are also plans to scale up the exercise to cover the remaining 55 cocoa districts in the country. So there are 70 cocoa districts and we are starting with 15.
A farmer who signs on to the scheme at age 50 or below is eligible to retire and receive pension benefits at age 55. A farmer who, however, signs on to the scheme after attaining 50 years become eligible to retire after contributing for 5 years, regardless of the age of entry.
That report was filed by our Ashanti regional correspondent Hafiz Tijani. That's all for City Business News on Eyewitness News, which was powered by citybusinessnews.com. I am Nashika Caesar. Up next is Point Blank.
Eyewitness News. Be there as it happens.
It's 11 minutes to the top of the hour. Tonight on Point Blank, we take you back to Parliament. As you may well be aware, the House has been considering and actually voting on the President's ministerial nominees. While voting has ended, counting has also ended. There's quite some discussion among the MPs in huddles. We're crossing over live to Parliament, where our correspondent Ni Ayikwe Okai is engaging Richie Sky on what's happening so far, whether they are picking up any signals, whether the nominees have been passed or not, at least before we hear it officially from the speaker.
The reality is that if you look at it, the constitution imposes an obligation on parliament. As I said, it doesn't tell us how exactly it should be done. But the constitutional requirements are implemented further by the rules of the House. So the standing orders make it clear that when it comes to election of people, necessarily it has to be by a secret ballot. Now, he was trying to argue that, well, if you could look at it closely, election is not the same as approval. So let us interpret approval to negate the requirement of election. Which election is the process we are seeing here? You understand? But the traditional approach that we have always used in this House is that where the House's report suggests that it should not be by consensus, but by a majority decision, then necessarily there has to be a voting in the form of secret ballot. Do you understand? So if that traditional approach is anything to go by, then there's no need invoking the constitutional provision and arguing a new approach that should be used. I mean, that what he was arguing for was alien to the practice of the House, and clearly there couldn't have been any adoption of what he was saying. That was exactly why the Speaker basically said that he was engaging in filibustering, and he overruled him, ignored him, and went on with announcing the process for voting to begin. So what he was saying clearly was to introduce an entirely new way of doing things in the House. Clearly, the practice and procedure of the House does not support that position. And I'm not surprised that the Speaker, overruled him.
So during the voting, we realized that two of the majority members, that's the Kumeu MP, Philip Baswa, and then Adwoa Safo MP for Don Kwabena, were not in the House to cast their vote. Is this in any way going to affect the majority?
Well, the signals I'm picking up Of course, I mean, it's still subject to confirmation by the Speaker. My indications are that they will most likely scrape through. We would wait and see what the Speaker would say. Of course, the absence of Adjoa Safo in the House, it's, of course, a blow to the majority side, but my understanding is that they prepared for that possibility. And then also, the chieftaincy minister former was hauled in with an ambulance to come and take part in the process, so he's here. But then there was one other member of parliament from the majority side who we are told also had a health emergency, meaning he had to be, you know, rushed out for some attention. You have heard the majority leader indicate that they were expecting a member from their side to come and vote. Unfortunately, he didn't turn up. Of course, those would necessarily go against the majority side. So if you were to take those out, then you say that they'll be short by 2 votes. That would mean that they have moved from 138 to 136. So if all the members of the majority side vote for all the nominees, then you should expect that they will get 136. But then also, you know that the NDC side, there are people with issues with the current leadership and the imposition of what I see. Okay, let's go back to
the chamber, because we just realized that the Speaker is about speaking, so we would move to him and then hear what he has to say.
Please resume your seats. Resume your seats. Honourable members, I'll start mentioning your names.
Mention specific names, but there are people who have gone on with their relationship for so many years, sometimes since childhood, sometimes from school days. So the question is whether, if it comes in for consideration, a person who is so close to, you know, the friend, virtually his brother or his sister or her sister, would say that I am voting against you merely because the party says so. It's a question that they themselves must answer. But as I have argued elsewhere, I believe that when party lines are being enforced the way they are being enforced across the two sides of the political divide, it would seem that we are making our MPs stooges. Make your case, stake the party line, and allow members of parliament to go and make their decisions, whether they are voting for or against, because ultimately, it was not the party that brought them here. The people in their constituencies voted for them to come and make decisions for and on their behalf. And none of them went back to his constituency to seek the mandate of the people, their views that, oh, we are considering X number of additional ministers. What's your view? Do you think that we should vote for them or we should reject them? None of them did that. So they are all towing party lines without having to actually consider the fact that they are not here on their own. So you would naturally expect that those relationships will be playing on the minds of members of the minority and then members of the majority. Like I said, the signals that we have picked up so far seem positive for the nominees, but that's not for me to say. It's for the Speaker to make an announcement. As to whether all of them will go through, it's another matter, but the signals thus far suggest that it will be a positive outcome for the government.
Yes. We saw the chairman of the NDC, Johnson Asiedu Nketiah, in the public gallery. Today we've seen the general secretary of the NPP, Justin Kodia, also in the house, as well as the NDC chairman. Is this in any way going to influence the vote that has been cast?
Yes, I know of specific measures that both sides have put in place to ensure that at least some or a good number, or all, that was the initial attempt, but of course there are people who are defiant, at least indicate what choice they are making in the ballot box. Of course, that defiles the sanctity of the constitutional and the parliamentary procedure that the vote should be secret. But that's where we are. It will come down to whether you can prove it, that a member showed his vote in one way or the other. My understanding and things I've seen tell me that there's remote electronic communication of choices that have been made by way of some proof to the leadership. I would, for good reason, of both sides say that both sides are giving that or they are insisting on that as a way of showing that yes, you are following the party line. But my understanding is also that some members of parliament have been defiant. They do not think that that is the proper way to do it, and so they refuse to communicate what choices they made in the booth, which is basically consistent with parliamentary procedure and the constitution, because when the vote is to be secret, it has to be secret. There's no requirement for you to show your vote through electronic means or to communicate the same through other means to the leadership of your party or leadership of your side in parliament. But I think it's going to be an interesting outcome. One thing I see is that if the NDC prevails in this vote, now what it means is that the leadership of the party has been able to enforce the party line, and their will is what would have prevailed at the end of the day. But if they fail, what it also means is that they showed their hands too early and sought to control something that they have no or absolute control over, and that will be embarrassing. Again, for the governing side, if it emerges that the government side loses, then it's a huge slap in the face of the president and his government. To a large extent, it will be a referendum sort of in parliament on the government's performance thus far. That's how far I'm prepared to go. And then also, it will send a certain signal that the MPs have specific concerns about government expenditure and then the size of government, because that is what every Ghanaian is talking about, that we are having to bear the burden of you coming all the time, pay new taxes that have been scrapped are to be reintroduced, businesses are being targeted with new, you know, levies and taxes. We do know of the fact that the government is currently in China with the finance minister seeking to get some relief from the Chinese in terms of the amount of money we owe the People's Republic of China. That has been used by the European states as a basis upon which they will, if we're able to get China to play ball, they will also forgive us some of our debts, as to make it possible for us to have some relief. And then also go back to the IMF and say that, look, we have been able to restructure our debts through debt forgiveness and many other measures. And then our own domestic debt exchange program that we have done, with the additional revenues that we hope to raise. And so the IMF should support the program that we have. Because all of these things are happening, Ghanaians are also insisting that, look, the size of government is too big. Reduce the size. Thus far, the president is not yielding. So a lot of people are angry. It would seem that that is a position the NDC wants to capitalize on and run away with it, because it is a popular thing to do. People are justifiably angry. The government is sort of failing to deliver They promised that with the numbers that they brought in to office in the first term, they were going to deliver the mandates that they were given in a way as to make it possible for the Ghanaian to realize that the NPP is the best possible choice there is politically. But thus far, it would seem that they have not been able to perform that responsibility in a stellar fashion. So Ghanaians are angry. So we still have a huge size of government. There is no justification for it in the eyes of many people. And that is why they insist that reduce the numbers. And so the NDC has sought to capitalize on that. And then also is hoping that the people from the majority side who have called for the removal of the Minister for Finance, and given the fact that the President has thus far not yielded, they would sympathize with the NDC position and use their anger at the system, reflect that in the way they vote, and slap the presidency in the face. The question is, would that happen? Whatever it is democracy that is at play. Win or lose, Parliament would have made a decision, and it would be up to the people of Ghana to go back to the polls in 2024 and reflect on the quality of Parliament they elected in the last election. Because we had hoped that the very delicate nature of these numbers would help us at least stop certain excesses of the government. But thus far, it will seem that the government is having its way.
If it turns out that some of the minority members end up voting in favor of these nominees, do they stand to be punished in any way?
Well, you see, that's what I said. You see, the only way you can punish a member for voting against the party line is to sponsor a candidate against him in his constituency and defeat him. Or you should have some sound basis in law to disqualify him from the race to seek re-election. It is a very difficult thing to do. Mind you, there are MPs who are here who can go independent on their own right and win in some constituencies. It is not true for all of them. So if the party wants to punish people for the choices they make, you also would have to recognize this fact that if the person decides to go on go independent, as we saw with the Deputy Speaker of Parliament, the first Deputy Speaker of Parliament, defied the party line, went independent, won. He's in Parliament now. The MPP had to go back kneeling to him now and begging him to transact business with him. Now, yeah, that's right. Now he's in Parliament as, yes, second Deputy Speaker. He's in Parliament. He's the second Deputy Speaker working with the majority. So that is one fact that the party would have to recognize if they have to even go that hard. The second reality is also that you first of all must know as a matter of certainty that a particular person voted against the party line. Yes, I have indicated that there is in place, or there was in place, a way of getting the members of parliament to communicate their choices to the leadership of the party. Some have done it. My understanding is that some have been defiant because they didn't think that was a proper thing to do. So if you don't know that the people voted against the party position, how are you going to punish them? Of course, those who refused to communicate or who did not communicate the choices they made, which I argue is consistent with the party, what do you call it, the constitutional provisions, and then also the rules of the house. The party can say that because you refuse to communicate that, although we will not take you on frontally on that matter, use other excuses to take care of you. It's a choice that the party has to make. But the fact is also that if you don't treat this matter cautiously, you will lose future votes in the House because the person is in Parliament until the next elections. And then also, as I said, the person can decide, look, I'm going independent. And either you lose the seat or he'll win it. Or maybe the candidate you put up will go through. But whatever it is, it will not be good for the unity of the party ahead of the 2024 election. So that's why my approach ordinarily would have been, if you disagree with a new nomination, as many people in Ghana have, put out a statement, say you reject it, tell your people to either stay away or allow them the free will to exercise their judgment the way they so want. At the end of the day, it should not be like people here in parliament have become stooges and are jumping merely because the party says so. I think that is not good for our democracy. It is not good for the judgment of the people who voted for them to come to parliament. And it is also not good for the image of the MPs themselves. I think it's wrong.
The question would be that if these nominees fail to secure the approval required, what happens? Are they going to be changed? Is the president going to nominate new ministers that would also have to go through the vetting process and all that?
Well, if you look closely at the rules of the House, when a motion is defeated, you cannot bring it back until the next session. So once that rejection is done, it would then be a question of whether the president will have to make new nominations different from these ones, because substantially, if you bring these people back, you are bringing the same thing back. But what the clever thing, I believe, which will be technical in law to do, will be that, for instance, if Brian fails to make it, you can renominate him, but make him minister for some other position. So maybe finance or security or something. Because in that case, although it is the same person, the technical argument, brilliant legal argument that will be argued or made is that he's not coming for the same position. He's coming from for a different position. So he should be reconsidered and a decision taken on the merits of his qualification for that position. So the way I see it, if they are rejected, those are the two options left to the president.
Will this affect government business?
Okay, so what are the issues? First of all, Alan has resigned from parliament, from government to run for president. So that position for now is vacant, although we have a caretaker in the person of Abuja Napo. So it is not like the government is not running. The government is running. Abuja Napo is performing that role. But the president thought that Katie Hammond should come and fill that vacancy. So it will be a substantive minister occupying the position, not someone performing a caretaker role. Then you also have Edu Buahin, who was also fired. He was fired because, for some reason, he was caught up.
Well, we've had to cut in that transmission from Parliament and make way for Panorama, Sports Panorama. The coverage is still live and ongoing on City TV. We encourage you to tune into City TV to follow the proceedings in Parliament. Voting is ended. Counting is ended. We're just awaiting the official announcement of the results. Interesting results, really. But we're awaiting the speaker to announce same. So this is how we conclude today's edition of Eyewitness News and Point Blank Extended Edition. Show has been produced by Kobna Welsin, Bevelyn London, and Fred Jabano. Earlier you heard Nashika Caesar. My name is Selom Adonu. Make a date with me tomorrow at 9 a.m. on The Big Issue, where we will discuss many issues, including the happenings in Parliament. Have a good evening.
City News, we speak first. Reach our hotline on 0302-224959 and get interactive on Facebook, City 97.3 FM, and on Twitter at City 973.
City 97.3, Accra.